Aristotle is my homeboy. Or at least that was the hashtag that I put up on that little video that I took of my little girl Maya when she rattled off modus ponens and modus tollens. If you don't know what they mean, we'll get into a little bit of that. Welcome to the Apologetics Canada podcast. This is Steve Kim, your host, and I have in the studio with me here Chris Battle.
Good morning or afternoon or evening.
Whatever time you may be listening to this in. Does that even make sense? Anyway.
We're not exclusivists here at the Apologetics Canada podcast. We encourage you to listen at any time.
Yeah, you might have noticed that things are a lot quieter on this episode because there is a notable absence.
There's a lot less Steiger going on in this podcast.
Yeah, he is actually not able to be with us this week. And next week, you're going to be away.
That's correct. Right. So it's going to be solo Steve.
Yeah. So next week, we're going to have a little bit of a detour with Steve like we've done in the past.
I love detours with Steve.
So that's basically where I basically present a paper that I wrote. Not in a kind of a boring, just reading it kind of a way, but...
pleasant presentation kind of way.
Yeah. So you can look forward to that. And then the week after that, I think it's just Andy and me.
Yep.
And then the following week.
We'll be back together.
The Three Musketeers. So last week we talked about that video, College Kids Say the Darndest Things.
Yeah.
Is that what it was called? From the Family Policy Institute of Washington.
Yep.
Where the director of the institute... Joseph Backholm,
yeah.
He went around University of Washington interviewing students. And basically what he did was reductio ad absurdum, meaning it's a tactic in logic whereby you grant your opponent's views and then see where it leads, what kinds of absurd things it leads to. Right?
Essentially take it for a test drive, right?
Right, and see what you come to. And clearly, what happened was, well, if you say that you can be whatever you identify yourself to be, then there's nothing stopping you from saying that you are a 6'5" Chinese girl when you're in fact a 5'9" Caucasian adult male.
Yeah. He threw a little slippery slope in there too, wouldn't you say? Like what the... You know, it was the logical, absurd conclusion, but then also kind of hinted at how far, you know, if we start granting, you know, in one case, bathrooms, then we're going to have to start allowing things like, you know, 30-year-old men to be 6'5" Chinese women, 7-year-olds in a grade one class.
Right. I think there what's happening is it's slippery slope. But I think a lot of people, when they hear slippery slope, oh, that's a slippery slope argument. It's almost as though this is not a valid argument. But there is the kind of slippery slope argument where one event is not connected to the next, right? Mm-hmm. This is not a logical slippery slope.
No.
So things like, you know, you can't go to movies because if you go to movies, the next thing, you know, like you'll be sleeping with your girlfriend or whatever, right?
Yeah.
The kind of really stereotypically puritanical code of conduct or whatever might have some kind of that element in it, you know?
Yeah, dancing and all that. Yeah,
no dancing because that'll lead to whatever, right? But there is such a thing as logical slippery slope.
And that would be something like if we got into some sorts of forms of marriage that were non-traditional, and then that could lead to, say, bestiality or marriages. Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, so in that case, if you open up the definition of marriage, now you have no foundation to put marriage on, so... anything goes in the end, right? So, another example would be, how do you define a person, right? Mm-hmm. If you deny personhood to the unborn, for example, or the preborn, what does that lead to? And it, so, in other words, if you define personhood by anything other than, say, the humanity of the person, like humanness of the person,
yeah,
then you have to found it on something that comes in degrees, right? Your level of development or your level of self-consciousness or something like that. So what stopped at, say, you know, first trimester abortion gets pushed further along. Okay, well, second trimester is okay. Or any at any point during the pregnancy, it's okay to kill the preborn. But now we're coming to the point where we're talking about, well, what stops us from, you know, afterbirth abortions? Now, people are talking about that, actually.
Yeah, and in some cases, they almost do. You know, where babies meant to be aborted are born and allowed to perish.
Right, and I think that's an example of logical slippery slope. And I think the video that we saw, college kids say the darndest things, that's exactly what he's doing. And he's using that to show, well, it leads to all kinds of absurd conclusions. There is a gentleman who, by the name of Richard Hernandez, who identified himself as a woman. So he became a transgendered woman, but that wasn't enough. He decided that he was experiencing species dysphoria.
Okay.
There is such a thing, right? For example, this one lady in the UK totally thinks she's a cat trapped in human body. That's
you brought that one up.
Yeah, and here is a gentleman who thinks he's a dragon. Now, there's nothing stopping him from identifying himself as a mythical creature, right? And so at what point does this stop?
Exactly, and that's the thing I think that the guy in that Joseph Backholm was bringing up is if we open up the idea of identity, what defines you as a person, and is not personhood, but the identity as far as gender and things like that goes, then where does it end, right? If you're not identified by your biological reality, as well as, I think, in part, the image of God, then where does it go, right? Mm-hmm. Because if you're a person would say, do that, the species dysphoria, a cat or a dragon isn't made in the image of God. So does that therefore make you not a person and therefore have those inalienable rights that we hold dear? Are you not therefore covered under those?
Yeah. There are things that if you push this line of thinking far enough, eventually you come to a point where even the person who affirms these sorts of open identity sort of views, there are things where they're not willing to compromise because it actually starts encroaching upon things that they hold dear.
Yeah, they only take it so far.
Yeah, so for example, Frank Beckwith, who teaches at Baylor University, he's a philosopher. I think he's Roman Catholic now, but he works really closely with the evangelical world.
He's a pretty intense ethicist too, wouldn't you say? Like,
One of the top guys that I've seen.
Yeah.
But anyway, he's a really brilliant guy. He wrote an article a while ago. This was a while ago, but this was before same-sex marriage was kind of sanctioned across the board down in the United States. And he wrote an article about how he starts off this one ethics course. And he starts this one class by asking the students, is there a difference between the questions, what is marriage and how do you define a marriage? And students will quickly say, no, there is no difference. Marriage is what you define it to be. I was like, okay. Is there a difference between the questions, what is a person versus how do you define a person? Again, the students are very quick to say, a person is just what you define it to be, right? And then this is where Frank Beckwith kind of takes them to you know, their logical conclusions.
I was just gonna say, folks, like your spidey sense should be tingling at this
right
point.
There, yeah,
the logic spidey sense should be going, wait a minute.
Yeah, because then what he says is, okay, so a slave owner thinks this white slave owner thinks black people are not persons. Are not human persons. now the students are really squirming in their seats, right?
Because yeah.
this
Wait
is
a minute.
What logically took you to, you know, their reasoning, right, took you right here.
Mm-hmm.
So I think stuff like that will eventually happen if you push this sort of really open, you know, open identity or open anything really.
Yeah.
Because you know, I think some things just really need to be closed because that's just the nature of truth. Truth is exclusive, right?
Exactly. And this is the problem with living in a hyper-individualized society is because we want to automatically make the I, right, the ego, the understander or the definer of all things. So we automatically just default to, yeah, well, you know, each individual can come up with whatever definition they want. But then you run into that situation like Dr. Beckwith came and put forward to them, and it wasn't even on their radar, you'll notice, right? And this is the problem with, and this is why we're bringing this up and why we're doing two episodes in a row, is we need to be thinking about why isn't there that should be an automatic for us. As soon as someone says that to us, we should be like, no. Wait a minute. That's or just thinking there is a difference between the two, how you define something and what something is. Mm-hmm. Obviously, there's a difference unless you could make it the same thing, but only if you define it correctly, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But so many students, they don't have that built in because they're individualized and they've been sort of reared in a society that has essentially told them what to think on some of these hot button issues, and they're ill-equipped to fight against that, right?
Yeah, and now we have a generation of people that that think whatever is legal goes. And so, you know, a lot of pro-abortion activists will say, when will anti-abortionists realize that abortion is legal? Like, right. So?
Yeah,
so what if it's legal?
Does 1940s Germany ring a bell?
Right. Because what they did was completely legal under German law, and they passed all the legislation to make it so. So just because something is legal doesn't mean... So law can go only so far.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, for example, you know, in Canada, unfortunately, we define a human person to kind of come about, so to speak, when you exit the birth canal, right? So you're not really a human person deserving of protection during pregnancy. You have to be born.
Unless you're somehow killed or something like that by somebody, like a perpetrator.
Even then, I'm not sure.
I think that I've heard of cases where people have been charged with a double homicide or vehicular homicide, say, in an accident and two bodies. But then again, I've heard the opposite as well.
Yeah,
but
the Cassie and Molly's law, I don't know if you've heard about that. This was a private member's bill that was being discussed a little while ago. I don't know what happened to it. They just had the first reading of it or something like that just last week or 2 weeks ago.
Okay.
And I think it involves a woman, a pregnant woman who got murdered, but only one murder, that the perpetrator was charged with only one murder. And they said there's something wrong with this. And this private member, I think from the Conservative Party, put forward the bill or something like that.
In the United States, there's something called the Unborn Victims of Violence Act. Of 2004, it recognizes a child in utero as a legal victim if they are injured or killed during the commission of any of over 60 listed federal crimes of violence.
Yeah, I don't think that's the case in Canada.
Okay,
unfortunately.
Yeah, I guess we're apologetics, Canada. So yeah. We need to. United States, you've got to step up on us. Yeah. Once again, Canada, congratulations. You've. Oh man.
Yeah. That's the thing, though. We kind of define, in Canada, we kind of defined a human person to be somebody who's sort of exited the birth canal. But how can law define a human person like that? Because if you think about it, humans are logically prior to the state.
Yeah.
Right? So then what the state can do is simply discover or recognize what already is. But what we're doing is having it backwards now, and we're having law define what things are rather than, you know, creating laws based on what things are. So, but anyway, these are some concerns that kind of I've been bouncing around in my head. But I think we wanted to kind of get into a little bit about some of these laws of logic and things like this, since we're talking about...
Yeah, not to the same depth that Maya is getting into. She's at a much higher level. Honestly, when I see videos like that, I'm embarrassed at the amount of logic. Like when it comes to a lot the logical fallacies and or logical argumentation and the Latin
the
and stuff like
inference,
that
yeah.
and all that stuff, I'm embarrassed by the amount I know. When I see a 2-year-old child rocking it, and I'm sitting there going, "Is that?" And I'm, "Is that what she's saying? Is that?" And I'm having, you know, it's pretty fun.
In the video, I taught her two laws of inference, valid inference. One called modus ponens, and the other called modus tollens. And I'll explain that in a bit, but I've added a third one now, and Maya is probably one of the very few 2-year-olds who knows how to say hypothetical syllogism. And I'm like, at first, I didn't think she could say it. It was just too big a mouthful, but she did it, so and she can tell you what it is. And she'll sit there and think about it, which is bizarre to see. She actually sits there trying to remember what it was.
Steve Kim, you're my hero. By the way, everybody, yesterday, Steve, or was it yesterday, the day before, Steve, your ninja-ness knows no bounds. I was standing by the door, or I saw him over by our desks. This is an aside. This is for free. We were standing over by our desk, and he's sitting there, and then I went up by the door, and I had my back. It was just a couple of feet away from the door. And then I was talking to somebody, and then I turned around to say bye to Steve, and he was gone from his desk, and I hadn't felt him or even noticed him go out the door. And then so I walk out the door to go outside, and I look down, and he's already in his car driving away. And it was I don't even know how time like sped up for him or something, or he just I don't know. Your ninja-ness was incredible.
Maybe I'm like that Japanese dude from the show Heroes, you know, stop time, get to the car, time again. Yeah.
Hero.
Yeah. It's all in my chubby cheeks.
Yeah. You know? He was a good character.
But anyway, the three classical laws of logic. Yeah. If you actually hear about these things, you'll find that they're just ridiculously simple.
Yeah. And this is, folks, this is what we're talking about. Andy likes to say this is logic is following rules of reliable thought. And if we get some of this down, then things like what Dr. Beckwith was doing, things like Joseph Blackholm, these situations are going to be a lot easier to work through for kids and for adults too, because there's tons of adults right now that are falling for this stuff too.
Yeah. Well, we're going to put up some resources on our show notes or whatever, but we're just going to scratch the surface for now, just to give you a flavor of this. The three classical laws of logic first, the law of identity, A equals A. Now, you might think that's ridiculously simple and intuitive, and you're right. The problem is, you'd be surprised how often this gets sort of repudiated, or people repudiate it without even realizing it. A equals A. In fact, if you don't have this law, you can't have a meaningful conversation at all. Any sort of, because if I have a smartphone here, right? When I say this is a smartphone, I mean this is a smartphone. I'm not going to pick up this mug and say this is a smartphone.
No.
The law of identity says A equals A. This mug is not the smartphone. But if you push that through, right, if A can equal non-A, then all rationality breaks down. You can't do science. You can't even have a meaningful conversation. You can't do anything.
No.
So this is a very foundational thing. But A equals A, that's a very basic but important one to remember.
And in fact, this is foundational to the Christian faith. Because in Exodus 3:4, we see God saying, I am who I am. Mm-hmm. And what God's saying is, I am me, and I'm not anything else. Mm-hmm. And I think we would all agree, we don't want God to be anything else if he is the greatest possible being that can be imagined, right? Like, if we go back to the ontological argument, God's the best, and right. we want him to be the best. We want him to be him, right? So God equals God, not anything else.
Right. And then there's the law of excluded middle, which says there's basically no middle ground between being and non-being, right? So then people quickly raise the objection, well, what about the idea of becoming, right? So, for example, I'm a musician, you know, like as I practice, I become a better musician. I am becoming. But actually, what the according to the law of excluded middle, it's either me that exists or doesn't exist, right?
Yeah.
It's not so much about the property that I have. It's just saying that there's no middle ground being and non-being. So I ontologically exist, like I am an entity that exists. I either exist or don't exist. There is no middle ground. That's what it's saying. So becoming is a matter of property, but
not reality.
Not like ontological object, so to speak.
Yeah. And then we can see this biblically when Jesus in Luke 11:23 says, either you're with me or against me, right? Like he's not, I mean, it's being simplistic, but he's not leaving room for middle ground.
Or another example would be, God either exists or don't exist. You can't have like kind of a middle ground sort of thing. Exists or doesn't exist.
Yeah, I was actually going to use that for our next one.
Yeah. So then the third law of logic is the law of non-contradiction. We love this one,
yeah,
especially in our very pluralistic society, because we tend to think that, you know, things like, we believe things like all roads lead to God, or, you know, we're all going to end up in the same, all religions are equal and valid. They all fundamentally believe the same thing. That's patently false.
Yeah.
So the law of non-contradiction says basically that two opposing statements can't be both true at the same time in the same sense. Now, this is really important, the last two phrases there, at the same time in the same sense.
Yeah.
Because a statement, two opposing statements can be true at different times.
Like it is raining and it is not raining, because it could be raining here in Abbotsford but not raining in London.
Or actually that would be that'd be a little bit different, but I'm thinking like time-wise, right? So it is raining at 8 a.m. It is raining at 3 p.m. Now, those two statements, it is raining, it is not raining, can be both true if they're happening at different times, one happening at 8 a.m., the other happening at 3 p.m. See what I mean? And you're right, too. Just because it's not raining here doesn't mean it's not raining in London, you know, that sort of a thing. But I was thinking specifically more along the lines of time.
But doesn't space count into there as well?
Yeah. Okay. Depending on what it is.
Okay.
Yeah. So another example would be Steve Kim is recording a podcast right now, right? Steve Kim is recording a podcast as opposed to Steve Kim is resting at home. Those two things can't be true at the same time, but they can be true at different times.
Yeah, or if there's two different Steve Kims.
Which would be the different sense.
Yeah, different sense.
Right?
Yeah.
So if I say Steve Kim is recording a podcast, and we by Steve Kim we mean one kind of a person,
yeah,
and namely me, and then if you say Steve Kim is resting at home, but by that Steve Kim, you mean somebody else.
Yeah.
Now, those names, Steve Kim, well,
the designations
two Steve Kims,
apply to different people.
Right.
Yeah. So this brings in the law of identity.
Right.
Yeah.
A equals A, right? Yeah. So those are really important. It has to be at the same time in the same sense. Now, then people bring up things like, well, what about the Trinity? Well, you know, how can God be one in three? Well, God can be one in three because by one, we mean it in one sense, and by three, we mean it in another sense, right? So God is one essence that is manifested in three persons.
Yeah.
That subsists in three different modes. That would be the sort of the more technical way of putting it in theology. But so those are the three laws of logic. And then it really helps if you kind of have under your belt a number of logical fallacies. And if you train yourself to spot them, it'll really help.
We link, if you go back to our last podcast, we put in under the things there some of the logical fallacies.
But here's the thing that I want our listeners to understand, and that is it won't be terribly difficult to understand each of these individual fallacies, but what's going to be challenging is for you to spot them in daily life, because it'll take a bit of practice to kind of, I guess, train yourself to spot them well on the spot, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of like math. Right, like you learn how addition works, how multiplication and division works, and things like that. But then you actually have to solve a number of problems to get used to. Okay, this is how it works. You kind of gain almost like tacit knowledge.
I was just gonna say it's tacit knowledge.
Yeah. So it's one thing to know it intellectually in your head, and then it's another thing to actually be able to skillfully spot those. The more you do those things, the more quickly you'll be able to pinpoint, okay, that's where this person went wrong.
Yeah. I think I wanted to quickly, before we get out of here, I wanted to bring up the idea of logic in the Bible or logic in the Christian faith. Because this is even right to say, but there's some verses that sometimes I wish weren't in the Bible. Mm-hmm. And one of them is Colossians 2:8, and it reads, "See to it that no one takes you captive by philosophy and empty deceit, according to human tradition, according to the elemental spirits of the world, and not according to Christ." And there's other little verses similar to that. Mm-hmm. They give us this idea that somehow philosophy and using logic and all of that is wrong. And mm-hmm. So we'll hear people say things like, well, we don't need to have logical arguments for our faith. We don't have to come up with, or the Bible doesn't even worry about logic. Why should we, mm-hmm. in a sense, right? And yeah. I really, really, really want to caution people because, I mean, Steve and I and Andy, we would all agree that the personal witness of the Spirit in our own lives is enough. Right, in a very fundamental sense,
that gives you a warrant to believe.
To warrant to believe that the Christian faith is true, we'll grant that. But we are not put on this earth just to worry about ourselves and to worry about our own witness. We're here to, and Steve talked about this earlier, but this is Dr. Craig's thing: is we're here not just to know our faith; we're here to show our faith, and it is impossible to show our faith without talking about it to some degree. And with that, it implies that we're going to have something along the lines of a logical argument. And this is where people, I think, fall apart: is they think, "Well, you know, logical argument, that sounds complicated. That sounds no. That in, all it means is having, as 1 Peter 3:15 says, a defense for the hope that is in us. And this is apologetics, and just being able to have an idea or an argument, not in a argumentative way, but in a showing my faith is true way, reasons for what I believe in a logical way.
I think one thing that we should really keep in mind, mm-hmm. is the fact that we all use logic. I mean, that's just how we're built. That's
exactly.
That's a part of being human. Everybody uses logic. The question is whether you use logic well or mm-hmm. poorly.
Yeah.
Right? Because without logic, you can't even have a conversation. You know, the only thing that you can do is just keep your mouth shut. And even then, every action that you take is going to be there's going to be some kind of underlying logic to it, right? I mean, you act according to the law of non-contradiction when you cross a road.
Yeah, Ravi likes to use that example, right?
It's either the bus or me. It's not both of us, right? and things like that. We use these kinds of examples for like Eastern philosophies a lot, because some Eastern philosophies, like for example, Zen Buddhism and things like that, they actually reject logic, right? So if you actually tell somebody who is a Zen practitioner and you tell them, well, you're being illogical and irrational, likely that person is going to actually take that as a compliment, because mm-hmm. that's the very sort of thing. But then the thing is, even though they reject logic, they can't live without it, because, well, you know, if you hold a kettle of boiling water over the Buddhist's head,
yeah,
I guarantee you that person's going to dodge out of there real quick. You know, and if you're just about to pour it, that person's going to dodge out of there real quick. Or at least if that person stays there, that person will expect to be burned, right? Because that's just reality, right?
Exactly.
And you know, you may be able to reject the law of non-contradiction, for example, but you're not going to be able to live as though it actually doesn't apply to you when there is a kettle of boiling water over your head that's about to be poured onto you.
Exactly.
So, there's a little bit of what do you want to call it?
I don't know, encouragement, maybe, to think about this. Because I think we just get scared sometimes in the church with the word logic. And I think this is, you know, this has been going on for close to 100 years now. With we have an underlying sense of anti-intellectualism or a fear of it, because, you know, people go away to college and they don't come back, right? And stuff. And I think we need to get over that fear. We need to gird up our loins, and we need to
gird up our loins
and intellectually, right?
Yeah.
And we need to get after this, because it like three. Well, I mean, there's so many more apologists, but I mean, just even from our stance, like three guys in a room with a couple microphones aren't going to change the world, nor should we, nor can we, right? It's the Holy Spirit, it's the gospel, but the Holy Spirit wants to use minds that are prepared. And we think Jesus, when he is speaking to the Pharisees and Sadducees and talking about the widows, and he's using logic when he's making the argumentation there. He's using logic whenever in his parables, when he's talking, if this is the situation, then this will happen, right? Yeah. Paul, when he's talking on Mars Hill, mm-hmm. logic. It's logic. Yeah. Logic, the Bible is replete with logic. And they don't say, hey, this is logic. They just say, this is just how it is, but they're using sound logic.
Yeah, if you're not convinced that Paul uses logic and is a philosopher, mm-hmm. Just read the letter to the Romans.
Exactly. It's one big fat argument.
Yeah. So, yes, there is a place for logic in Christianity. In fact, that's been the case up until very recently, that this sort of anti-intellectualism is a very recent development
for
the fundamentalist and modernist controversy in the late 1800s and early 1900s.
Yeah, and then it culminated in, it was peak was in the Scopes trial in 1925.
Yeah, if you're wondering why these terms in logic are in Latin, it's, well, partially because logic was prerequisite to doing theology.
Yeah, and this came about, by the way, in the so-called and in and amongst the Dark Ages, right?
Like, right.
Which is a misnomer, but at any rate.
Yeah. So with that sort of banter, we're going to close this week's episode.
Yeah.
Next week, like we said, we're going to have a little bit of a detour with Steve, and then we'll come back with more.